Good morning and a very warm welcome to this time of worship, the time when we acknowledge the worth of ourselves, of one another, and of all creation. For those of you who don't know me, I'm David Darling, and I'm a member of this congregation. Sarah, our minister, is having a well-earned day off today. Just to apologise in advance that we might have some noise from the road menders outside. But as my father pointed out at the beginning, at least people won't fall asleep during the sermon. We begin by lighting our chalice candle, the symbol of our worldwide Unitarian Universalist community. We gather this hour as people of faith, with joys and sorrows, gifts and needs. We light this beacon of hope, sign of our quest for truth and meaning in the celebration of the life we share together. And some opening words from Kenneth Patton. Let us worship with our eyes and ears and fingertips. Let us love the world through heart and mind and body. We feed our eyes upon the mystery and revelation in the faces of our brothers and sisters. We seek to know the wistfulness of the very young and the very old, the wistfulness of people at all times of life. We seek to understand the shyness behind arrogance, the fear behind pride, the tenderness behind clumsy strength, the anguish behind cruelty. All life flows into a great common life, if only we will open our eyes to our companions. Let us worship not in bowing down, not with closed eyes and stopped ears, but let us worship with opening of all the windows of our beings, with the full outstretching of our spirits. Life comes with singing and laughter, with tears and confiding, with a rising wave too great to be held in the mind and heart and body to those who have fallen in love with life. Let us worship and let us learn to love. The first reading that I'd like to share with you this morning is taken from a book by a Quaker Buddhist, Jim Pim, on Buddhism and healing. It's a story from the Taoist tradition, and I think you may have heard it before, but it's always worth hearing again. Who knows what's good, who knows what's bad? An elderly farmer had a beautiful horse. One day it ran away. His neighbours came to commiserate with him on his loss, but all he said was, "Who knows what's good, who knows what's bad?" The horse returned, bringing with it several wild horses, and his neighbours came to congratulate him on his good fortune. All he said was, "Who knows what's good, who knows what's bad?" His son started to train the wild horses, but one of them threw him and he broke his leg. His neighbours came to sympathise with the farmer, but all he said was, "Who knows what's good? Who knows what's bad?" The emperor's army marched through the district, press-ganging every young man into service, but they did not take the farmer's son, as he had a broken leg. The farmer's comment was still, "Who knows what's good? Who knows what's bad?" The second reading I'd like to share with you is taken from a book that I was fascinated to see on the bookshelf in Waterstones. I was struck by the title, How to Be a Bad Christian and a Better Human Being. And it's by an Anglican vicar, Reverend Dave Tomlinson, who's a vicar in North London. But for a long time he ran a pub church. He had people met in the bar of a local pub. And this is from a section called We Have a Need for Personal Authenticity. Rabbi Zusha, the Hasidic teacher, once said, In the coming world, they will not ask me, why were you not Moses? They will ask me, why were you not Zusha? The problem is that it can take a long time to find out who we really are. It took me 30 years to even start to understand who I am. There is a wise old Quaker saying, let your life speak. But I was too busy listening to other voices to hear my own inner voice. Of course, I was not unusual in this. Most of us initially formulate our deepest truths and values from the ideas and examples of people we admire and look up to. But there comes a time when we must stop being mere echoes of others and start to listen seriously to our own life, to become authentic. The Quaker teacher Parker Palmer writes, before you tell your life what truths and values you have decided to live up to, let your life tell you what truths you embody, what values you represent. In other words, trust the divine within yourself. By all means, admire and learn from God in others, but then discover the divine within yourself and be true to that. Morality must not be reduced to a checklist cobbled together from the ideas of great people or from the Bible that we then try to emulate. A true sense of meaning in life develops when we discover the truths and values at the heart of our own God-given identity and honour them. Only in this way are we living our own life, not someone else's. Personal authenticity means being true to yourself and to what you believe. In your relationships, in your business dealings, in your financial decisions, in the way you treat strangers and friends, in life's many choices and transactions. Meaning comes from living your own life, not someone else's, and living it with integrity, proud to be who you are in your deepest and truest self. Some thoughts from Reverend Dave Tomlinson. Like many of my addresses, the thoughts for this one were sparked off by a trip to a coffee shop. Not my usual cafe in Soho, but one of that famous chain unloved by tax collectors, near St. Paul's Cathedral. As I was sitting at a table outside the cafe in Paternoster Square, soaking up the amazing architecture of the cathedral and the surrounding buildings, my eyes were drawn not to an intricate detail of the buildings, but to small holes in the waist-high windbreak that marked the seating area. I was a bit intrigued at first as to why the small metal-bordered holes were there. Then I realised it was to let the wind through. The very thing that was there to act as a barrier to the wind had within it a feature that allowed the wind through. Of course, without these tiny holes there, there was a danger that a gust of wind would simply topple it over. I was reminded of something I read years ago in my children's encyclopedia. You remember those things that we used to consult in the years BG before Google? There was an article on what to do in the event of a hurricane. Now, I expect that most of us, when faced with a raging hurricane outside, would batten down the hatches and try to make our property as secure as possible. The article, however, instructed me to do quite the opposite. It said that in the event of a severe hurricane, we should open all the windows and doors to allow the wind through the house. The rationale being that if there was no way for the wind to get through the house, it would simply destroy it in its path. As I sat sipping my coffee, I wondered, what do I do with the spiritual equivalent of hurricanes? It's interesting to note, well, at least for me it is, that spirit and wind come from the same words in Latin and Hebrew, ruach and spiritus. What do I do with those bits of me, those desires, influences, those what used to be called evil desires? Do I batten down the hatches, shut all the windows and doors, and struggle to keep them out? Or do I acknowledge them, welcome them in, and let them pass through quickly? Compared to Christianity, Judaism has a much more pragmatic approach to what Christians often refer to as temptations or evil desires. The Hebrew yetzer hara can be translated as the evil impulse, the evil desire, the selfish desire, or just simply desire. It is that aspect of nature that drives us to compete, to fight, to possess, to satisfy all our appetites. Yet in Judaism, this yetzer hara, this evil influence, is seen as a necessary evil, as that which makes the world go round. Rabbi Jeff Dennis from North Texas wrote on this subject in a recent blog, and I'd like to share some of it with you. He writes, though it is counterbalanced by the yetzer hatov, the altruistic desire, yetzer hara, the evil desire, is nonetheless the source of much of the grief in human life. Lust, violence, selfishness, vengeance, and ambition. One would think that humanity would be truly better off if we could destroy this impulse. I always think in the context of John Lennon's Imagine. It has struck me that Lennon is thinking of something akin to the yetzer when he wrote that song. Imagine if human beings were finally free of all the selfish desires, no thoughts of property, security, self-aggrandizement, or the future. Wouldn't things be perfect, or at least a whole lot better? Is Lennon right? Well, in fact, the sages of the Talmudic times anticipated Lennon by about 1600 years and imagined just such a scenario. This is their mythic account of the day the muse almost died. And they cried with a great voice to the Eternal, their God. What did they cry? Woe, woe, it is he, the yetzer hara, who has destroyed the sanctuary, burnt the temple, killed the righteous, driven all Israel into exile, and is still dancing in our midst. You have surely given him to us that we may receive merit through him. We want neither him nor merit through him. In that moment, a tablet fell from the firmament, the word truth inscribed upon it. Heaven accedes to the request. They, the sages of the great assembly, ordered a complete fast of 3 days, whereupon he, the yetzer hara, was surrendered to them. He came forth from the Holy of Holies like a fiery lion. At that moment, the prophet declared, this is the yetzer, cast him in a lead barrel. But the yetzer said to them, realize, if you kill me, the world is finished. They held him for 3 days. Then they looked in the whole land of Israel, and not one egg could be found. So they asked, what shall we do now? So they put out his eyes and let him go. This helped in that men became less inclined to evil. Well, an odd story. But it teaches a most profound truth. We see evil in ourselves, it offends us, and we think the right thing to do is to totally purge ourselves of it. Yet we don't truly understand it, for things we so easily characterize as evil actually spring out of the very nexus of holiness. Surreal as it is, this account makes an incredible point. It is the strife of the spirit, the very struggle between our impulses that makes the world work. Without it, the world as we know it would cease. People and animals would no longer be driven to build, to create, to have children. In short, life as we know, including not only evil aspects, but most of what we regard as beautiful also would cease. Without desire, life itself would slowly wither away, and that would be a sad thing. So the goal of the spiritual person is not to destroy the selfish impulse, but to sublimate it to God's purpose. to be truly what God wants us to be, to achieve our fullest human potential. We need to learn to bend both our impulses to godly ends. The very struggle between the impulses is what makes the world work. This thought of balancing different desires reminded me of something I read about aeroplanes and the way that they land in the right place at the right time. Now, if there are any aviation experts among you, you can challenge me later, because I may have got this completely wrong. But apparently, planes have a thing called an inertial guidance system when it's gone, you know, pilotless, automatic pilot. And the purpose of this system is to get the plane within 1,000 yards of the runway within 5 minutes of the estimated arrival time. Now, within 1,000 yards of the runway doesn't seem quite accurate enough for me, but presumably the pilot can actually overcome and override that. But it apparently works by correcting the direction of the plane when it goes off course. The plane may go too far to the right, so the fault is corrected by veering it to the left. It then goes too far to the left, and it's corrected by veering to the right, and so on and so on. Apparently, the plane arrives at its destination in spite of having been in error, going in the wrong direction, 90% of the time. So, on our spiritual journey, on our human journey, we shouldn't worry or feel guilty when we seem to be going off track. For if we notice that we are off track, we must have some idea of the track that we should be on. Noting that we are off track is a good thing, for then we can get back on track and reach our goal, even if we seem to be off track 90% of the time. Acknowledging our different desires and being aware of where we really are on our spiritual journey, we need to both accept ourselves as we are. Most of us start our spiritual journey with high ideals and black and white views of what is right and what is wrong. As we grow older, and if we are honest, we realize that life isn't that simple. We begin to see that our virtues can become vices. Caring can become controlling. And our vices can become virtues. Anger can be transformed into passion for justice. As Dave Tomlinson wrote in our second reading, Rabbi Zusha said, "In the coming world, they will not ask me, 'Why were you not Moses?' They will ask me, 'Why were you not Zusha?'" And morality must not be reduced to a checklist cobbled together from the ideas of great people or from the Bible that we should then try to emulate. A true sense of meaning in life develops when we discover the truth and values at the heart of our own God-given identity and honour them. Only in this way are we living our own life, not someone else's. But acknowledging who we really are, acknowledging our own conflicting desires, is not always easy and can be painful. Over the years, many of us have put on layers of emotional barriers to protect our most vulnerable selves. In his book, After the Ecstasy, The Laundry, the Buddhist writer Jack Kornfield recounts and reflects on a Swedish myth that deals with this issue. And it's the story of a young girl who is given over to a dragon. Because of the mishaps of her parents, this young princess named Aris must be betrothed to a fearful dragon. When the king and queen tell her, she becomes frightened for her life. But recovering her wits, she goes out beyond the market to seek a wise woman who has raised 12 children and 29 grandchildren, and knows the ways of dragons and men. The wise woman tells Aris that she indeed must marry the dragon, but there are proper ways to approach him. She then gives instruction for the wedding night. In particular, the princess is bidden to wear 10 beautiful gowns, one on top of another. the wedding takes place. A feast is held in the palace, after which the dragon carries the princess off to his bedchamber. When the dragon advances towards his bride, she stops him, saying that she must carefully remove her wedding attire before offering her heart to him. And he too, she adds, instructed by the wise woman, must properly remove his attire. To this he willingly agrees. As I take off each layer of my gown, you must also remove a layer. Then, taking off the first gown, the princess watches as the dragon sheds his outer layer of scaly armour. Though it is painful, the dragon has done this periodically before. But then the princess removes another gown, and then another. Each time the dragon finds he too must claw off a deeper layer of scales. By the fifth gown, the dragon begins to weep copious tears of pain. Yet the princess continues. With each successive layers, the dragon's skin becomes more tender and his form softens. He becomes lighter and lighter. When the princess removes her tenth gown, the dragon releases the last vestige of dragon form and emerges as a man, a fine prince whose eyes sparkle like a child's, released at last from the ancient spell of his dragon form. Princess Aris and her new husband are then left to the pleasures of the bridal chamber to fulfill the last advice of the wise woman with 12 children and 29 grandchildren. That, for me, is the gift of our liberal religious community. We should be a safe place where we can remove our armour, where we can be honest, where we can deal with our conflicting desires, where we can begin to remove the scales of the layers of scaly armour. Perhaps we need to begin with tiny holes in our barriers, like the ones outside the coffee shop. But we also need to remember that all of us, to some extent, are struggling to become who we are. It's easy to think that I'm the only one who needs support. Everyone else should have got it sorted so that they can deal with me. No, all of us are messed up kids who get it right sometimes and get it wrong sometimes. But together, we can help one another grow into the people we are called to be. Amen.